This is case number 56224, Financial American Group v. C.H. Montrose, LLC. Mr. Byrd for the appellant, Mr. Gunnarsson for the respondent. Mr. Byrd, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time.
Sure.
For rebuttal, please. May it please the Court. We're here today because the breaching party under a real estate contract wound up with a $3.6 million windfall, even though they were in material breach throughout the course of the dealings with my client. The inherent inconsistency here between the trial court's decision on summary judgment and the decision that was entered after trial on the merits clearly demonstrates that this matter needs to be reversed and submitted back to the trial court for a full trial on the merits. The initial flawed legal analysis that the court applied at summary judgment basically centered around the fact that the court concluded that even though C.H. Montrose was in material breach of the contract, that they still had the right to cancel the agreement with my client. And that was really the underlying predicate upon which the trial court granted summary judgment not only to C.H. Montrose on its breach of contract or our breach of contract claims and tortious interference claims, but also in favor of the First American Title and its employee, Tamara Turner.
Your client never deposited the money into escrow, did they?
The money was eventually deposited on May 18th into the escrow, and that was part of the money didn't come from my client. It came from D2 Capital, but it was deposited into the escrow on May 18th.
As to FATCO, though, my understanding of this record is summary judgment was granted on the issue of causation, that the district court accepted the timeline argument that contract was canceled by at least May 15th, if not earlier, and the disclosure of the double escrow did not occur until 3 days later. So even if you credit every element of the claim against them, you still can't make causation, and therefore they deserve judgment as a matter of law. That's my understanding of the basis for the trial court's ruling.
That is correct, Your Honor. That was the basis of the ruling, but let me explain why I think that that ruling was incorrect. First of all, it goes to the issue of whether or not there was the legal right to cancel the agreement.
But, sure, but let's assume for the sake of argument that there was.
But in order to arrive at the court's decision, the court made, or accepted at least, and made certain inferences from the facts that I think were inappropriate during the summary judgment procedure. And that was the fact that these parties were continuing to negotiate as to when this second deposit was actually going to go into the escrow. And that entire week from May 11th through May 15th, there was a whole series of emails and negotiations between the parties that suggested that this deal still had some life to it.
So you're saying that they lost the opportunity to breathe life into the ashes of a dead or dying deal?
That's part of it. But I also.
But on that point, I have a question I'm trying to get to. On the findings of fact during the trial, even if I credit that there was an issue of fact on the causation issue and summary judgment shouldn't have been granted, you have a finding of fact on page 22 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law entered after trial. Let me know when you're there, because I have a question about it specifically.
Page 22, Your Honor?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I'm there.
At lines 22 through 27, where the court says, further, this court is not persuaded that Mr. Gaylor was motivated to cancel because he may have known about the double escrow.
Yes.
When I read that, my question was, where does that leave us vis-a-vis your claim that there was a question of fact as to causation that should have defeated summary judgment?
Well, I think, first of all, this finding is somewhat skewed because of the fact that there wasn't a full trial on the merits on all of the causes of action. But if you look at it from the standpoint of the basis for that finding, particularly at summary judgment, the court was essentially relying on the testimony, self-serving as it was, of Mr. Gaylor himself, who was saying, oh, well, it didn't make any difference to me that, there was an additional $3.6 million to be made here. I would have canceled the deal anyway. I mean, that issue in and of itself suggests that there were issues of fact to be tried to the court and that summary judgment is inappropriate. So while the testimony of Mr. Gaylor was to the fact that, well, I had already terminated this deal, if you also look at the email that Tamara Turner sent out to Mr. Gaylor that actually disclosed the double escrow,
That seems like it's a live deal at that point in her mind.
I think that's powerful evidence because she's the double agent. She is an agent not only for my client, but also for the C.H. Montrose parties. She is supposed to know. She is being paid to know what's going on in the transaction.
But if we were to say you're correct and we're going to remand and give you a trial on the FATCO claims because causation was not established as a matter of law, would you not be stopped dead in your tracks by this finding of fact on remand that we just looked at on? Do you see what I'm saying?
I don't think so, because I think at that point in time, if the court were to remand, we would be entitled to have, first of all, a complete trial on that issue and to explore in full the motives and whether or not, in fact, there still was life here. So I think a full trial without the issues being truncated by a summary judgment could lead to a different conclusion by the trier of fact. Okay.
I didn't mean to derail your argument, but that was what's concerning me. So.
No, but I think that's an important issue here, Your Honor, because, and again, I point to the email itself disclosing the double escrow. Why disclose it if the deal truly is dead? Aside from the legal issue of the inability as a matter of law of a party in breach to be able to cancel. So I think that's a legitimate issue, and I think that the facts that the court relied upon in granting summary judgment, it made certain conclusions and inferences that it believed to be true, that there's equal inferences on the other side that suggest that they may not have been true. So I think that's one of the reasons that it's important to reverse and remand for trial, at least with respect to First American Title. The other issue that I think is important is with respect to the court's finding after the trial that there had been a material breach of the agreement by the C.H. Montrose parties and then refusing to grant any relief to my client on the good faith and fair dealing claim. Certainly, if the court concluded that it was a material breach to not provide the escrow documents and the due diligence documents, that certainly frustrated the expectations of my client under the contract. And yet the court saw fit not to grant any relief under that theory because it concluded that somehow we hadn't proved the claim and that there had to be a deliberate action by the C.H. Montrose parties in order to recover for the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Certainly the fact that it breached the agreement suffices to establish the essential element of frustration of purpose of the contract. And so we feel that, at least as to that claim, this court would be entitled to grant judgment in our favor and to remand then just for a determination of damages on that claim alone. I think one other thing that may have played into this is perhaps a fundamental misunderstanding of how these deals work at the trial court level. Certainly when money goes into escrow and it's about to go hard, as it did in this case when the $500,000 actually got deposited, a seller in that position has a difficult choice to make. Regardless of how rocky the negotiations have been and the transaction has been, it puts the seller in a difficult position because he has to assess, do I go out and look for a new buyer and maybe have to start this process all over again? Or am I satisfied now that the money is in escrow and that I can then proceed to close and get this deal done?
Or that this person has been so difficult to deal with that I'm going to have him in my life litigating with me for the next 25 years. I mean, there's
different scenarios there.
There is, but that buyer, that seller's decision becomes significantly skewed once that seller knows that there's someone else with an additional $3.6 million waiting in the wings. He doesn't have to go out and look for a new buyer. He's got a new buyer. So I think that that essential fact is important to understand that perhaps the trial court made some assumptions and made some conclusions and perhaps came to the conclusion that the double escrow, you know, shouldn't have been going on. But as we all know, double escrows are a fact of life in these types of transactions. Unless the justices have any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
You have about 4 minutes and 40 seconds left.
Thank you.
Mr. Gunderson for the respondent.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Spencer Gunderson, and I represent the respondents First American and Tamara Turner in this matter. The evidentiary timeline in this case is clear. This appellant blew all of its deadlines to deposit $400,000. It filed a complaint, and it refused to sign an escrow instruction amendment. And as a result, the real estate deal issue imploded.
What do you do with your opposing colleague's argument that there was a genuine issue of fact as to the disclosure of the double escrow pouring water on the embers of this dying deal, if you will? In other words, you couldn't decide causation as a matter of law because had there not been a ready, willing, and able buyer at the other end of the double escrow, this seller might have said, okay, I'll continue to deal with you even though I don't have to.
I think the important thing, first of all, is to keep in mind the totality of the facts. And here we've got six main pieces of evidence that happened prior to the disclosure. We have the May 7th letter from Montrose's counsel stating, in fact, specifically, my client is given Financial American until May 11th to make the subsequent deposit or he's going to cancel escrow and pursue the remedies for your client's breach. We have the May 11th deadline that comes and goes, no deposits made. We have the May 14th instruction, which, despite an appearance that they were entertaining the notion of extending the time for the deposit, the Montrose parties instruct Ms. Turner to continue with cancellation. We then have, and this is really important, they file a complaint on May 15th. And that complaint contains judicial admissions that the Montrose parties were seeking cancellation and have anticipatorily repudiated the contract. They knew on May 15th that this was being sought to be canceled, if not already effectively canceled. And then, of course, you have May 16th, the next day. And this is, I think, the linchpin, is the fact that there's an email sent from Financial American's counsel to John Pacheco at Financial American stating, finally, and this is important, the Montrose party said that the amendment must be signed and delivered by 10 a.m. today. There's no room for wiggling there. It had to happen that day. And we see the sixth piece of evidence. We see Mr. Gaylor's frustration. It's clearly made evident in his email to Mr. Pacheco where he says, John, you guys are idiots, and yes, we'll see what happens. It's clear from the evidence leading up to that this deal wasn't dying. This deal was dead. This deal had imploded. The only evidence they're showing to contradict that is, number one, Tamara Turner's apparent belief that in fact, the deal was still ongoing. Tamara Turner is not the Montrose parties. The facts leading up to May 16th shows us what the Montrose parties were doing. Tamara Turner receives a $400,000 deposit. I don't know if that, because she receives a $4,000 deposit, I think there's probably some assumptions that are being made that, oh, okay, I guess this is back on. But there's no evidence in the record, and that's the important
part. So the email post-dated the $400,000 being deposited?
It did. Yes, it did. And in fact, there's nothing in the record that shows that there was any discussion between Tamara Turner and Bill Gaylor about Bill Gaylor believing this deal was still on. And I think that's what's important. There's no evidence of that. All we have is speculation that, in fact, because she may have believed it was on, then therefore Bill Gaylor must have believed this was still on, that this thing still had life. What we're looking at, on page 5 of their brief, I think it's important to note, they state what the question is here. And they state that the question, and I'm not going to quote it exactly, but it's essentially, when did Bill Gaylor believe the deal was done? Those are my words, not theirs. But that's what they state on page 5 of the reply. That's the real question. Not when did Tamara Turner believe the deal was done, but when did Bill Gaylor believe the deal was done? The second point that they make as to why incorrect inferences were made, and they should be reasonable inferences, not any inferences, but was in fact related to this idea that why would he have given up $3.6 million? That obviously influenced him. But the fact remains there's also nothing in the record that shows when Ms. Gaylor ever learned of the amounts available. It's not there. Throughout their briefs, they make it appear as though it's this common understanding and that there's these facts that show that Bill Gaylor immediately knew there was $3.6 million on the table to gain on May 18th. And that's simply not there. The record we have before us doesn't show us when Mr. Gaylor knew that that was available. And so for that reason, it's not an incorrect inference, or it's not an inference that was missed. It's an unreasonable inference, which is more akin to speculation. They're speculating that he must have known the amount. There's no evidence as to when he knew that, or that he even knew that before he entered into the deal with DII Capital months later.
But the standard on summary judgment is all reasonable inferences from the existing facts. And I think his point is that the existing facts are this seller went ahead and closed with the ultimate buyer for the money that the midterm buyer would have realized as free and clear profit, and from that they're asking you to infer that that colored the existence of that double escrow buyer colored the Montrose party's decision. I mean, that's their point, and that there was at least a reasonable inference from those facts that maybe that had something to do with it, and therefore causation couldn't be ruled out as a matter of law.
And my response to that would be that I don't think that is a reasonable inference.
Okay.
It's not a reasonable inference to say that a deal that happened months later, where he did realize, if not the whole thing, a large portion of that that $3.6 million, that in fact means that on May 18th and the days following, that he was aware of that, and that somehow influenced his decision to fight them on the complaint. Because remember, a list pendants gets filed. This is the procedure. The list pendants gets filed, and then there's a motion to expunge the list pendants. Only when that motion for expungement of list pendants is granted do they then continue with a deal. So there's no facts in the record that show that prior to that list pendants being lifted that he was even aware of the $3.6 million. So it's not reasonable to infer that simply because that deal was done.
Could you comment on the finding of fact after the trial that I drew to Mr. Bird's attention and its proper role in our analysis here?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up. That's one of the points I wanted to point out as well, for the very reason that I think that you've been drawn to it. You know, obviously we're here because of the motion for summary judgment order, and that's what's at issue with our respondents. They then go to trial. They were able to put forth whatever evidence they want. We weren't there. We couldn't counter with our evidence. They could make their argument. We were unable to make any arguments because
you were gone.
We weren't there. And yet still, despite the fact that we weren't there making the arguments, the court still finds that they are unpersuaded that the disclosure of the escrow had anything to do with the damages in this case. And so as a result, I think that it sends the message home, is what it does, that they're clearly, whether at the motion for summary judgment or at trial, this was not an issue.
What about this Raines case that it's been a point of contention and the holding in that case? And I know it also discussed estoppel and waiver and all, but what's your thoughts on that?
But my thoughts, first of all, is that the Raines case is almost entirely specifically at issue as it pertains to the appellants and the Montrose parties who are not here. And that was a line of discussion and questioning that went on between them. In fact, they've tried to bring that in as it pertains to their argument that there was some kind of legal, or that there wasn't a legal right to cancel on May 11th. And they've used that to determine breach and what conditions were there. But when it comes down to it, that doesn't matter as it pertains to the causation question with First American and Tamara Turner. Because
so the issue remains, the summary judgment was reversed, saying there was issues of fact on waiver and estoppel. You're saying that it doesn't apply to First American.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And it's because regardless of whether or not the court were to make a determination that cancellation was legal or not legally done on May 11th, it doesn't affect the fact. And go back to the question they said, when did Bill Gaylor say it was done? Or when did he believe it was done? And it's clear from the facts that was, if not May 11th, May 16th. And therefore, legal determination that they didn't have a right to cancel doesn't preclude them from taking the actions of cancellation. That's why it doesn't matter. Because regardless of how the court turned on that issue in Raines, it doesn't affect First American.
Okay.
The other issues that I wanted to point out, they stated that all we relied on in the motion for summary judgment was the direct testimony of Bill Gaylor. That's not true. If you look in our reply, you can see that we outlined those six pieces of evidence that I discussed previously. Those are in direct support of Mr. Gaylor's direct testimony, and direct testimony should not simply be discarded because it's there. It obviously holds a lot of weight, but it's not the only thing. Those six pieces of evidence leading up to that disclosure also are important and only serve to support Bill Gaylor's direct testimony.
What about the rules on double escrows when you have the same title company involved and all like that? I mean, what's the latest on that? I know, as Mr. Bird said, I remember they were pretty common when I was practicing and all, but how do you deal with ethical responsibilities and all with them?
Right. Well, I think that the straightforward answer is, given that this is an issue of causation, it doesn't actually come into play here because we have specifically avoided the issues. We admitted there were genuine issues of material fact as it pertained to an escrow officer's duty to disclose a double escrow amount. We understand. We may not agree with their position, but we understand that that's there. We also understand that there would be genuine issues of material fact as to whether or not that was breached. So, first I'll say that whatever answer we give doesn't necessarily apply, but I think there are. It is an important issue because you do have information being disclosed, and there needs to be care taken. But to the level that care is not discussed or at issue on the appeal because we're focused solely on causation.
Okay.
I also wanted to point to the fact that whether or not, you know, we didn't look at a standard of a causation, but in looking at the double escrow or the disclosure of the double escrow, we don't have to look at a but-for cause standard or a substantial factor because it was dead on the 16th, which means it didn't ever even make it to the 18th. And I wanted to emphasize that one more time. I also want to touch briefly on the title commitment issue. I know that they've stated that there were genuine issues of material fact and that summary judgment was improper as it concerns the title commitments and the alleged failure to provide that. I would first note that of the five main claims for relief at issue, only two of them appear to address the title commitment issue, and that is a breach of the fiduciary duty as well as professional negligence. And in both those cases, we're looking at proximate causation. I think that's important because if you look at the title commitments and the facts of the title commitments, the appellants would want you to believe that what we should look at is what was provided by April 3rd. Now, if you recall, title commitment was provided, had the wrong title on it, and then three or four or five days before the close of the due diligence period on April 3rd, a letter sent out saying we don't have the extended policy commitments. If that were where the timeline stopped, if that's where the cancellation ended, I think there would be an argument that, in fact, proximate causation may not be determined on a motion for summary judgment level. However, it's not just that. We have April 9th, where there was an attempt made to fix the title on the commitment. We have April 16th, where Mr. Pacheco, a Financial American, admits that what he received was an extended policy commitment. And we have a letter of April 18th, where Tamara Turner says, you know, basically, just in case there's any confusion, she says, Alta extended owner's policies will be issued if and or all requirements have been met to First American's title satisfaction. These efforts were being made continually. And then after April 18th, you hear nothing about title commitments. There's nothing in the record to show that there was any concern between between April 18th and May 15th when the complaint is filed that anyone has any concern. As a result, in looking at proximate causation, there's no actual causation. It did not, whether you use the but-for standard or the substantial factor standard that they use in Dowd, where you have multiple causes. You cannot say at that moment that that was a substantial factor of the deal dying. It's impossible. Because no one's complaining about it. Continual efforts were made to be done to get it completed. And therefore, it's not the cause in fact. Secondly, if looking at foreseeability, given the work that was being done to correct the issue and the apparent belief given the facts that the issue had been completed, it wasn't foreseeable that that would then be a substantial factor in the deal dying, which is the foreseeability standard. It's for these reasons that, and the totality of the facts as they pertain to causation and the clear lack of genuine issues of material fact regarding the disclosure and the alleged failure to provide the title commitment, that the district court's order on First Americans and Tamara Turner's motion for summary judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dempsey.
Mr. Byrd, you have 4 minutes and 38 seconds for rebuttal.
Mr. Byrd, I'm just curious, you can come on up. At any time did, after you got into this trial, and I understand it was a four-day trial, did you ever ask the court to consider reopening the summary judgment as to First American, or did you just proceed with the Montrose parties at that stage?
I don't believe that request was ever made, Your Honor. Okay. It was simply a trial on the issues that were still remaining.
Okay.
I would just like to make two points. One, with respect to the activities and the title commitment. I think it's important to recognize here that one of the elements that the trial court found was a material breach was the absence of the appropriate title commitment. So in this case, First American Title is responsible for one of the elements of the breach of the underlying contract. And that in and of itself subjects it to having responsibility for us losing, quote unquote, the contract with our seller. In addition, the question of whether or not the causation should somehow be obviated because, and we'll be back in the same position, I think that the reasonable inferences that could be drawn from the facts in this case show that this deal was not dead. The part of the causation issue is, and that the court really didn't focus on at summary judgment, was the fact that First American Title was partially responsible for the C.H. Montrose party's breach in this situation. The other thing that I think is important is First American argues that there's nothing in the record that shows that Mr. Gaylor really knew the details of the underlying deal that we had with D2 Capital. But the facts that are part of the record from which that inference can be drawn are, one, C.H. Montrose and First American Title did substantial business together. Two, the escrow between D2 Capital and my client was that First American Title. So if Ms. Turner disclosed the existence of the escrow, it's reasonable to suggest that she also disclosed other details about that same escrow. Finally, I think it's important to note that the fact that this contract was ultimately terminated doesn't release First American Title from its obligations to us under their contract with us. And I think that's an important issue here. We're focused on the causation and the double escrow, but there's also another element to this, that First American Title had a contract with us that required it to perform certain duties and obligations to us, which it didn't do. And so therefore, I think that's an independent basis on which the summary judgment could be reversed. And the causation question is not as important to that determination.
In other words, that the duty of confidentiality didn't die with the cancellation, even assuming it was validly canceled.
Correct. That there were ongoing duties. It'd be no different than
attorney-client
privilege, where he's not my client right now, but I still have ongoing duties to him. Unless the justices have any questions.
Anything further, Justice Pickering? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Connison. Thank you, Mr. Burr, for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted.